Well, a couple of things. You know, when you see things like Dr. Bregan talking about some of the global issues and who profits and who wins and who loses, our story in Alsea is in a microcosm. We were ahead of the game as a small school district. All our kids had devices. And so we were one of the first in Oregon to switch to the comprehensive distance learning without even being told. And then once we, even though we did it very well, it was very clear that it was inadequate. So we made the decision to open. And every month, the governor kept changing the rules. And she created metrics that said nobody could open. And fortunately, we reached out to our legislators, Senator Finley and Senator Lipcomb and others, and they created the rural exception. And we opened with all eyes on us. I mean, we were the only full-time K-12 school open. We opened in August, west of the Cascades, for those who aren't familiar with Oregon. And we were able to show through a whole bunch of mitigation and safeguards that you could safely operate schools. It is now February. And we have still had zero cases of COVID that have been able to be zero cases, period. No cases have been traced to being sourced at the school. And yet most schools in Oregon are still closed. And just so everyone understands that, I finally said this to Director Colt Gill just last week, because ODE is now advising districts not to release kids to the Alsea School District, either for our brick and mortar or for our online program. And I explained to him that's a violation of RS 338. We are not a virtual charter school. And according to law, kids cannot be denied access to our programs. And we're in the middle of a pandemic. Kids aren't being educated, suicide rates, home stress, domestic violence. I think we have, I think we need to keep the kids out front. And I just got an email today because I want to serve kids even if we don't get paid for them. Things are really bad out there. And I got an email today saying, well, you can go ahead and serve them, but you better not try to get paid for them. And this is from the director of education, and he is appointed by the governor. Something is very, very wrong. I asked Director Gill, why aren't we getting accolades in Alsea? Why aren't we being praised as a school that could? For all the good that we've done, on the huge waiting list we have, the massive number of board members who have come out to Alsea so they could see what it looks like to open a school during COVID safely. I can go on and on, but you know, it goes back to what former speakers have talked about. It's counterintuitive that we wouldn't be held up as an example of what can be done. And so I really want to encourage people, get connected and be active. You know, my claim to fame, and probably the reason I was asked to be on this panel outside of running a school, was I started pushing back, and Commissioner Sterritt knows, I started getting active, and I wrote a letter encouraging counties to open up, because we had so many kids trying to harm themselves. The hospitalization rate, visits in the emergency room for students attempting suicide, those kids tying it back to not being in school, being isolated, being stuck at home. And I took it real personally, so I challenged the Oregon Health Authority epidemiologist. And boy, did I not know what I was getting into, but I have a science background. And I said, look, your data doesn't make sense. We've got, as of October 20th, we've got, exponential number of cases being identified, but hospitalization rates are going down. That's impossible. You cannot have a threefold increase in 10 days of COVID identification cases and expect to see hospitalization rates going down. Well, what I didn't realize and what came out of it was the hospitalization data comes from a different source. And so the epidemiologist challenged me about stochastic analysis. And I said, well, great, where is it? I don't see it on your website. And then he just got quiet and he said, why are you doing this? And I said, listen, I'm being told I have to close my school in January. We're heading into the winter break. I'm trying to determine whether or not, under these metric rules, I can stay open, and I need good data to do that. And I don't have it. So the summation of that is, I told him, I said, look, you go back to OHA and report that Superintendent Thielman needs to have his school open, and he needs safe, what we call safe harbor in Oregon, which means we can stay open once we're open. And I said, they've ended safe harbor. I've asked them to extend it. And if they extend safe harbor, I'll get real quiet real quick. Well, 2 hours later, safe harbor was extended through an email from Deputy Superintendent Colt Gill, serendipitously. The next morning, I'm driving to work, and there was an emergency OHA radio announcement on the radio news, AM radio, that they think we're nearing the end of this most recent COVID spike, as evidenced by a reduction in hospitalization rates. And that's when I realized something's very, very wrong with that. That's impossible. You can't be a superintendent, call in and do that and have it on the news the next day. If the data is scientific, objectively, rationally based, it's not. So I'm kind of upset because more kids, your kids are suffering. Education is not getting done. And we need to really take a long look in the mirror, our political leaders, and get back to what we're supposed to be doing. And that is serving kids and families, being here to as a state and federal government, serving the people by which those governments exist to serve, and not the other way around. Thank you
so much for that. For those listening, remember that this data disaster has such profound implications. And here's a shining example of a school that could, and your school where you live can as well, if we can only get this information out. And again, the call to action at the end of this broadcast will enable you to be empowered to help make that happen. So Dr. Breggin, we're running a bit behind, but we'd love for you to close this panel off with just telling us, how does this make you feel to hear all of this, and what encouragement can you get our viewers?
Well, the biggest encouragement I want to give has not been talked about again very much. So I want to point out that we have a huge amount of information on the early treatment, the prevention and early treatment of COVID-19. So I want to give you some resources real quick. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons, that's all you need to know. You can even go with AAPS and Google it. And they have a blue book right up there in front on the early treatment and prevention of COVID-19. Incredibly successful. It began with hydroxychloroquine. Now there are other medications as well. They're all cheap. And the government doesn't want cheap drugs going out to the folks. So you have to go to the people who are really involved with that. And one of the doctors named McCullough, one is named Zelenko. These are people you can find, and they're very, very important. About the children, it's about treating all of us as if we're objects in some consumer play. I mean, the kids are consumers now. They're a market. That's a better word. We're all been turned into a market. And the children is just awful. And now we're marketing vaccines to them. And we're going to do that without any of the vaccines having been tested on children. I don't know if anybody mentioned that before. Vaccines have not been tested on children. But now we've gotten the okay from the good old boys, the FDA, CDC, whoever's Fauci was ever pulling the strings, and we're going to be giving these kids, Mark, these wonderful kids we should protect, we'll be giving them vaccines. I think that we just have to get another view of kids other than there being a market for crappy videos and violent movies and sex and all the other stuff that, I mean, I don't think I could grow up today. I mean, a person is full of stuff as I am, I would have been done in by just my own overstimulation with all the things our kids today have to deal with. So our kids are in trouble, and COVID-19 is just one more example of the way we just use them to make money now. That's what the culture's doing. It's partly the absence of religion, I believe. It's partly the absence of moral education. Our founders said to have a Democratic Republic, we had to give moral education to everybody, to the children especially, everybody had to read. And by moral education, they also meant the belief in freedom, which we haven't heard maybe enough about today either. because they're taking away our freedom, and they were taking away the kids' freedom. They're turning us into a way to make money this way and that, and it's we got to look into that very big picture.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bregan. Exactly. That's why we're doing this event, and we are together providing a means for people to take back control of their basic health rights and human rights. So again, thank you, panelists. We're going to move on to panel number four, roundtable number four, including Anna Gardner, Dr. Martin, and Senator Lynn Ethicum. So we'll start with Ms. Gardner. We've known that you filed impressive legal arguments in New Mexico, Ohio, and federally as well as suits against the CDC. So many people are desperate to know that something and someone is bringing the legal challenges. What can you tell us about the cases you're currently working on?
Well, the compromised data and the misleading data is the thing that is driving the suffering in my state, New Mexico. And that prompted me to start looking at what lawsuits were happening around the U.S. And it wasn't until I saw Tom Renz's lawsuit in Ohio, which Dr. Bregan mentioned working with him, and actually he submitted a short affidavit in support of the Ohio lawsuit. And I started working with Tom. I called Tom and I said, look, I think you're on the right track. Nobody else has figured this out yet except you. And that is, he knew that he had to attack the entire base of this narrative, which is there is no public health emergency. And the way that we look at this is we're looking at all of the data that came in. How did this start? They're basing this public health emergency on the fact that there were modeling assumptions made by the Imperial College of London that were just absolutely so far off the mark that they were ridiculous. But what did they do? They instilled a whole lot of fear in a whole lot of people. Millions of people are going to die, Fauci said, remember? So that started the whole cascade of false information that was being fed to all of the people who only get their information from mainstream news or perhaps the newspapers. If that's the only place they get their information, they're going to be horribly misinformed. So that's the beginning of it. Then we have the cases and the COVID-related deaths. And Dr. Ely covered that very, very well. But the COVID-related deaths in New Mexico, we have a population of 2.1 million approximately. And I just looked at the numbers on the New Mexico Public Department of Health, and they said that there are very close to 200,000 deaths in New Mexico due to COVID. That is not correct. We've had a data analyst actually get copies of the death certificates, and you can tell just from the death certificates that they're miscoding them. So in his analysis, he figured that only 15% of these deaths actually died with no comorbidities or trauma. So obviously they're not looking at these things correctly at all. They know that they're fake, and they're scaring everybody into just, you know, a terrible isolation, fear, and depression. We have fake numbers on cases. We have fake numbers on deaths. These PCR tests, nobody has really come out until this kind of event, come out and talked about how meaningless and unreliable the PCR tests are.
Will you close your laptop?
Excuse me? Anyway, the PCR tests, of course, we know have a false positive rate of anywhere from 70 to 90%, depending on what sort of cycle thresholds are used, depending on what reagents are used. There's so many variables. And it appears that the PCR tests were also marketed under the emergency use authorization, which means they didn't get tested. And they were done, they were created in the absence of a virus being isolated that was claimed to have caused this group of symptoms called COVID. So we have meaningless PCR test. We have the whole myth of asymptomatic transmission that was almost completely and conclusively rebutted in the almost 10 million person study done in Wuhan. There was zero asymptomatic transmission. in this huge number of people. So that is not part of the any bit of the truth that's driving this public health emergency. And in fact, that asymptomatic transmission narrative is driving a lot of very oppressive measures that are being done by the government. For example, mask wearing, social distancing, isolation, stay home so that everybody's safe. They're quarantining healthy people. They are claiming that healthy people are now asymptomatic, which implies that we're all walking germ vectors. That's just not true. You know, I'm a healthy person. Pretty much everybody I know is healthy. In fact, I haven't known but a couple of people who may have gotten COVID. I haven't known anybody who's died from actually the disease. I've known people who got sicker from taking flu shots. So it's been so overblown that it's ridiculous. So we're trying to attack it. Tom and I have been, we've now filed three suits together. We're involved in three suits, and we are attacking it on the lack of a public health emergency. If we, and we fully expect to win this at some level, no matter where it's going to be, but we fully expect to win this. When that is won, that there is no public health emergency, all of the measures that have been instituted fall by the wayside. There's absolutely no basis whatsoever then to have any of these measures. So this is what we're claiming. We did it in the Ohio suit. Between the time that the Ohio suit was filed and the New Mexico suit was filed, so much more information came out about the unreliability of the PCR test. The fact that a Portugal high appellate court found that the PCR tests were completely useless at determining whether traveling people coming into Portugal needed to be quarantined based on the PCR test. So they've thrown that completely out in Portugal. Governor DeSantis in Florida recently said that all PCR tests need to have the cycle threshold listed because that will decide if they're really contagious or not. Because if you can only find it a positive result through a high cycle threshold, then that means there is so little virus that they could not even possibly be contagious. A study in France basically said that after 17 cycle thresholds, the reliability of the test falls off dramatically. And they don't recommend any above 30. However, all of the existing labs are using cycles, and we found out in New Mexico, they're using cycles of 40 and 45. How reliable can that be? So obviously we have to attack this on everything we have. And we say there's no public emergency, no public health emergency, because the basis on which this was declared, they're all completely fraudulent and fake. Now, we haven't claimed fraud in our case in terms of the governor committing fraud or somebody committing fraud, but we're saying the numbers are fake. The numbers are fraudulent. So that's the focus that we're doing. And, you know, Dr. Ely talked about the math and everything and that people couldn't do the math. Well, even the CDC admitted that 94% of all of the deaths that they had coded being related to COVID had comorbidities, and that only 6% of them probably actually had COVID. So how bad an emergency can it be when we're talking about survivability rates of 99%+, depending on your age group, and the fact that most people have, they say, they're either asymptomatic or have very mild symptoms. Well, asymptomatic people are healthy people. They didn't have COVID, most likely, because they never had symptoms. So it's not like we're all just asymptomatic or positive, or, you know, it's we're healthy or we're positive. And the positivity needs to be correlated with clinical symptoms, which they have not been. That's, you know, they have not been tested. There's no gold standard for this. But we're the last suit we filed was the CDC suit that we filed, which is to ask them to stop coding these deaths. In fact, I just talked to someone this morning about a gross violation of the whole coding thing. Gunshot wounds in a small county in Colorado. The coroner there asked the governor to please take those off a COVID diagnosis or a COVID-related death, and the governor refused. But these are gunshot wounds. This is this is potentially a criminal action of murder or homicide or something else, but now it's being coded as COVID. What do you do in the legal system when they didn't really die of gunshot wounds, they died of COVID because they had a positive PCR test? It's absurd. What do you do when somebody is coded as COVID and they should be able, their family should be able to get an accidental death insurance policy? But COVID isn't an accidental death, it's a contagion. It's usually excluded from insurance claims. There's so many ramifications that can come from coding the deaths incorrectly. Besides the fear and hysteria, lockdowns, masks, social distancing, we have all sorts of problems that arise as a result of that. The suffering that's happened in New Mexico has absolutely been a level that I never thought I would see come into the United States. And that's what prompted me to get to come out of retirement, basically, and start fighting these things. And we're seeking other attorneys who are health and freedom liberty lovers, as we are, because we know the next step from this is mandatory vaccines. And that's another thing that we want to, I'm going to call it the, what Dr. Ely calls it, the experimental biologic technology, something like that. But at any rate, we know that that's the next battle that we're going to have to fight here, because that is the natural consequence of what we're doing and where it's all going, and we see that. So I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to tell people, you know, and educate, provide something that I've learned about and all of us have learned about, and get people to thinking about this, that what if this whole narrative is totally false and totally incorrect? Then what? Do we go back to living normally? I think so. You know, that's my goal. And I'm doing everything in my power to make that so in New Mexico, because it will have a far-reaching effect in other places. So,
wow, Anna, that's an incredible summary of all that you've learned and are doing on behalf of us all. Thank you so much. So, Senator, you've been involved in some very interesting cases concerning COVID public health policy. What do you think about what you've heard, and what do you think about calling for a formal investigation, and what would you personally want to see investigated? I think you're still muted, Senator. I think we'll get assistance with that. There we go. Hi, Senator. Okay.
Well, first, at the federal level, and for the CDC in particular, the Information Quality Act was meant to ensure that policies were backed by valid scientific and technical information. And there's a requirement. Okay, I'll start up again.
Okay.
At the federal level, and for the CDC in particular, the IQA, the Information Quality Act, was meant to ensure that policies were backed by valid science and technical information, along with the requirement that it be rigorous, precise, and useful for constructing sound public policy. It also codified the public right to see the source data, the models and the algorithms employed, and the internal and external standards for the review process. This is not optional. This is an agency obligation, and it clearly has not been done. Sayer, you asked me, what would you like to see investigated? And quite frankly, everything needs to be reviewed. Not only audit the data, but review the assessment processes, the determinant factors for policy discussions that weeded out relevant items in favor of promoting irrelevant data points. This, in 2020 hindsight, all of this has happened, and we here are asking these questions, and the public deserves the answers. The hardest area, and maybe the most important area, would be to review the moral hazard that has been instigated and promoted by federal healthcare funding models, and the counterproductive not only counterproductive, but moral hazard associated with COVID-19 incentives on death certificates, for example, what Dr. Ely was describing. Here in Oregon, actually across the U.S., but especially here in my state of Oregon, states like New York and Michigan, information is slowly surfacing that shows the breadth of misinformation and the severity of modeling errors. And these agencies, quite frankly, must be held accountable. The public has to understand and recognize the soundness of the quality, the objectives, the utility, the integrity, the scientific and technical, even statistical information that the agencies are adopting and disseminating for public policy. All of these appear to be a one-sided, if you will, top-down, one-size-fits-all approach. And we, the public, should know this by now, and it's about time we relearn this saying from Lord Acton: power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we are in the midst of trying to figure out, how do we promote liberty, regardless of our race, our gender, our political affiliation? How do we create a bridge to the future that can unite all of us in the common cause of defending our liberty to pursue our own medical choices without the nanny state stepping in and forcing us to do one thing or the other? So we need to vigorously defend our values by not being deceived, by not allowing us to fall prey to new definitions or inaccurate assessments of the real facts. And more than anything, we simply need to stand and defend the truth. So all of it needs to be investigated. Bring them tab to my office and I'll see what we can do within our budget.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Senator. So Dr. Martin, we have some questions for you. Same questions, actually. What do you think about what you've heard? And is a formal congressional and or special grand jury investigation warranted? What would you want to see investigated?
Well, a couple things. First of all, Dr. Jack and I, just so everybody knows, are actually not at all on opposite pages or even on at all conflicted with respect to the RT-PCR. The CDC patent on the RT-PCR is largely to blame for the fact that the CDC chose to take a path that the rest of the world didn't choose. And that was because they could force others not into the market because of their patent, which gives rise to a very fundamental requirement for investigation. Under the Bayh-Dole Act that was debated in 1979 and passed in 1980, science in this country got hijacked by industry. And this is regulatory capture. This is old school corruption. This is racketeering. This is antitrust violations. This is price fixing. Remember that Anthony Fauci sits as the purveyor of an industry that was built on universal, in sequence, HIV, influenza, and now coronavirus vaccine promotion. His business, $191 billion of public funds, has been used and hijacked. $191 billion under his leadership has passed through his fingers to achieve three failed objectives. First, HIV vaccine. Second, pan-influenza vaccine, which he said was going to be an infant imprint vaccine. And third, the coronavirus vaccine. Let's call it what it is. This is racketeering, this is antitrust violations, and it's being perpetrated using taxpayer dollars. This is, in fact, a criminal conspiracy, and it needs to be called what it is. And what Dr. Jack is going to talk about with RT-PCR, I just want you to know I'm fully, fully endorsing what he's going to be describing, because the issue is simple. By filing patents on the use of RT-PCR for coronavirus, we do not have an independent gold standard anywhere, not in the US or around the world. And the reason why we can debate the application of RT-PCR is because CDC, under the Bayh-Dole Act, was allowed to preclude anyone from independent inquiry into doing any form of diagnostics. So this is actually something where, going back to 2003, the ability to have independence has been blocked by the illegal and unethical use of the Bayh-Dole Act from 1980. There has to be an investigation into the racketeering. There has to be an investigation into the antitrust violations. And this fundamentally brings criminal, not just civil, complaints. And that's the important thing. We need to show that this is not an oops, I got it wrong. This is a criminal conspiracy. It must be treated as such. And we must have leaders who have the courage to get U.S. attorneys and district attorneys and attorneys general in states to actually bring the appropriate legal action, which is not civil, it's criminal. And we must address this issue because this is a $191 billion criminal crime syndicate. And in any other place, we would actually have people cuffed and doing perp walks. And right now we're handing those people awards, presidential medals of honor, and it is an absolute assault to everything that we stand for in this country. So I am all about congressional investigations. We have delivered the Fauci dossier by hand to every one of the senators in the United States, taking a playbook from 1911 and 1912. We're calling for a Peugeot Commission-like investigation, which, as you probably know, historically gave rise to the Clayton Act, which is the reform of the antitrust acts in the United States. We are calling for exactly that same thing now, which is a Peugeot Commission for COVID that the Congress takes on to bring about a investigation into an ultimate legal reform, which ultimately will constrain the abuses of the 9th and 10th Amendment of the Constitution. And with that, I could go on forever, but I appreciate having the opportunity. I look forward to hearing the rest of this presentation, but I really want to cede the ground to people who are much smarter than me. And let's get the next panel on.
Thank you so much, Dr. Martin, for that. So Ms. Garner, you have the floor for final thoughts.
I do think that certainly filing a criminal action is a very appropriate thing, because I think that this has been a criminal enterprise. We felt that filing the civil actions, and Tom and I are both civil attorneys, we're not criminal attorneys, and those type of actions need to be brought by attorney generals or by district attorneys. But in filing the civil actions, we feel that we are taking the most direct path to freeing up our liberties that have been completely taken away from us. Our liberties of freedom to move around, freedom of association, freedom to worship, freedom of expression. We have so many freedoms and liberties that have absolutely been shredded during this declared pandemic. And that is the time when our constitutional rights are the most precious and need to be upheld the most. It's during times of emergency. That was what our founding fathers envisioned, and that's what we're going after. These are constitutional law cases that we're presenting, and that's why we're in federal court. But we're doing everything we can to get these types of draconian measures reversed so that we can go back to living our lives normally and save whatever businesses are still able to hang on throughout these considerable restrictions that have been imposed on them. So we want prayers. We need prayers. We feel that this is also a spiritual battle in many ways. We ask for prayers and we ask for support from people for what we're doing here. So thank you.
Thank you so much, panelists, for this very powerful roundtable. So we'll be moving to our final roundtable for the evening. We have Dr. Jack, Dr. Ely, Superintendent Thielman, and Dr. Breggin. So we'll start with Dr. Jack. This PCR test seems to be one of the biggest problems with trusting the data being reported by the CDC. What can you tell us about the problems we've been hearing about the COVID PCR test?
Yeah, first, I absolutely will. I'm going to give you guys some slide presentation in detail that you'll never forget. But first, I want to address Dr. Martin's view and my view on this. You see, if society wakes up and says, you know, based on Dr. Henry Ely's paper, that there's a massive conspiracy theory and epidemiologists, state epidemiologists, every public health official all across the country are all in bed with Wuhan, this is not going to fly. What we have to do is we have to say Dr. David Martin's dossier is a stunning indictment on people who set this up. And what I meant by disagreeing was on the very specific motivation, specifically on why they won't budge on the fact that we have a flawed PCR test. They screwed up the test. They stumbled all over themselves. They would have had the cat in the bag 100% if they didn't ship out that test. They wouldn't need any commercial tests at all. It was Anthony Fauci, in fact, who said, I guess we're going to have to turn to the commercial test. So if CDC flipped out a test, they'd have the license on it. Everybody would have to license to CDC, and they'd be the richest organization on the planet. So it's absolutely willful misconduct at the highest levels. And I totally support Dr. David Martin. But I want to be sure, because the way that information propagates through social networks and so on, your head can be spinning on how could there possibly be such a massive conspiracy. The people in the middle, they really don't know what's going on. They're good soldiers. There's an emergency. You have to run the test this way or it's going to get out of hand. And that's the distinction. It's a subtle distinction. But I'm going to cut right to, if I may, cut right to the presentation that I have here.
Please.
Thank you. Okay, so what I've done, this is IPAC Research, independent research organization. When we talk about deaths and diagnosis, and when the middle ground epidemiologists say that there's no false positives, there's such a wide different number of definitions of types of false positives. You can have the false positive of the test. You can have the false positive of the test in the lab with artificial sequences. You can have the false positive of the test in the field on real patient data. And you can have a theoretical estimate of the false positive just by doing blasts, which is what FDA asked for. What I'm going to do is I'm going to show you every factor that has to be considered to understand the accuracy of the assessment, the ascertainment of the death. So this is about the diagnosis in the situation where there's a death involved. It also is directly applicable. I was on top of this way back in April, and you can go watch the Unbreaking Science episode, CDC's Deadly Testing Fiasco, and you'll find there that Chris Meekins is a whistleblower that came out and said that CDC actually lied to the President of the United States over readiness of tests. They were stumbling all over themselves. But here we have this is going to be a big decision tree. We have somebody who's died. They have a COVID-19 test before or after their passing. The test is positive, or they were tested and it was positive. This implies that the virus is present, but that actually in this situation, it means yes. In this particular patient, the virus was in fact present. In this particular patient, the virus was in fact viable. And in this particular case, the virus caused the death. We know from other published research, this is not my research, but other published research, that the CT value itself, if you set the CT threshold too high, you're going to end up with false positives and non-transmissibility. You're going to end up with deaths that are not attributed, that are attributed as causal, but they're not causal because even though it tested positive, the person didn't die from it because the virus wasn't even viable. And the World Health Organization's recognize that the PCR CT scores have to come down. This is their notice. This is the Sentinel article showing that Kansas actually did the same thing. They're bringing the CT scores down, and I expect state after state is going to start dialing back their CTs. So in this decision tree, if the virus was present, and the virus is viable, it still could be unrelated, such as in the situation of a person that has COVID-19 who's killed by a shotgun blast. So that death should not be attributed. We just heard about that. That was a brilliant point. But we also have, in that case, would be a false positive. So in the very first category, we have the true positives. And then in the second category, we have a false positive because the virus was viable but unrelated. And then we have the virus was present but not viable. That's another category of false positives. And then we also have the fact that the test might have a false positive rate itself. This is the clinical test false positive, the technical false positive rate that we're talking about. Everybody else talking about false positives hasn't even addressed the other two categories of false positives. So with the virus actually being absent but the test scoring positive, that those are the rates that are published by Basile and Lee and Wernicke. And they're a stunning indictment on the use of PCR just to detect the virus, let alone to do the clinical diagnosis and the mortuary analysis. So here we have an example where, yeah, the person's tested, but the test was negative. And then Then we have, of course, the possibility, well, the virus isn't there, but there's consequences there. Another category that joins that test negative are people that aren't tested at all. There are people that die, they're given a COVID-19 test. No, they're not given a COVID-19 test. So we're going to call those test negatives as well. And then, and this is where the presumed positives come in. This is where Dr. Ely was referencing earlier that the test is assumed positive.